You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Mark Zaid and John Tai. Mark is a managing partner of the law office of Mark Zaid. He specializes in litigation and lobbying on matters relating to international transactions, torts, crimes, national security, foreign service, and diplomatic immunity, defamation, and the Freedom of Information and Privacy Acts. Through his practice, Mr. Zaid often represents former, current federal employees, intelligence and military officers, whistleblowers, and others who have grievances who have been wronged by the agencies of the United States government or foreign governments, as well as members of the media. He's also the executive director and founder of the James Madison Project, a Washington, D.C.-based organization with the primary purpose of educating the public on issues relating to intelligence gathering and operations, security policies, national security, and government wrongdoing. John Tai is a founder and executive director of Whistleblower Aid, which we'll be talking about a lot today. Before that, he served as section chief for Internet Freedom in the State Department's Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor from January 2011 to April 2014. In that capacity, he traveled overseas and advocated for the open use of the Internet, free from government interference and monitoring. In July 2014, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post outlining his concerns about signals intelligence collection under Executive Order 12333. Also with his attorneys, he met with the Inspector General of the State Department and the NSA, the House of Representatives Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and gave public statement to the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, also something we'll talk about today. So gentlemen, welcome to SpyCast, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
So John, I want to start with you because we can use some of your personal experiences to kind of frame our conversation today. So can you tell us a little bit, jumping right in, how you became a whistleblower?
Yeah, so I was at the State Department. I worked in the Human Rights Bureau on Internet Freedom. And so my job was basically free expression, privacy rights online around the world. So dealing with, obviously, countries like China, like Russia, but many countries around the world. After the Snowden leaks, we were focused on reestablishing the U.S. position with respect to privacy rights in forums like the U.N. Human Rights Council, the U.N. General Assembly. There were resolutions in both of those venues. There were also a lot of bilateral issues with countries like Germany, obviously, and others related to the Snowden leaks. So we were more or less deeply involved in the diplomatic response to those leaks.
So, but you were State Department. You're looking at other countries and their internet freedom. What made you privy to classify top secret information? It doesn't sound like a job that might have access to this kind of info.
So, part of my job was implementing various human rights sanctions related to internet censorship. So, as with that, I had a top secret SCI clearance to learn about what various companies and country governments were doing to restrict the internet in their country. So that's how I had a top secret clearance. Following the Snowden leaks, there was a big push in various venues like the UN General Assembly, the UN Human Rights Council, on to make statements on privacy issues. And so for us to adequately respond to those, I got briefed about the extent of U.S. signals intelligence collection so that we could adequately represent American interests.
And this is a time when everyone was focused on what was called Section 215 of the Patriot Act, because that's a lot of what Snowden was talking about, the metadata collection. So everyone's attention is on one particular type of bulk data collection the NSA was doing.
Yep.
You actually focus or tried to change everyone's focus to a different direction, saying something that was much more potentially dangerous than Section 215. And that's, we'd already talked about, Executive Order 12333. So what did you see that you thought was especially problematic?
Sure. So there are two different legal regimes, one for domestic activities by the NSA and one for international or activities outside the borders of the United States by the NSA. FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and all the various amendments to FISA over the years govern domestic activities of the NSA, and that's where all the focus was immediately following Snowden, and really for a year following Snowden. What my complaint was in fact, 12333, which governs foreign activities by the NSA, was a far bigger threat to Americans' privacy. And the way that works is every time you send an email, like I live in Washington, D.C., I send an email across town to Mark Zaid here, that's an email from one U.S. person to another U.S. person. If we're using Gmail, that email itself gets backed up to over 20 different countries around the world, all the different Google data centers around the world. So one of the reasons, you know, if one data center goes down, then it's backed up elsewhere. So even entirely domestic communications between two U.S. persons are stored in multiple countries around the world.
So literally you're sitting 3 inches away from Mark right now. If you sent him an email on your phone, even though it travels 3 inches, I'm putting air quotes around that, it's being bounced around and putting in different countries around the world.
Many different countries around the world. And once the data leaves the borders of the United States, it's treated by the NSA as foreign person's data. And so basically all the protections that Americans get under FISA, which are limited and insufficient as they are, none of those limited protections even apply at all to the stuff collected under 12333. When you send a Gmail and it ends up in over 20 countries around the world, it's treated as a foreign person's data. The NSA goes and collects it, and they treat you like a foreigner, which basically means you have extremely limited, close to zero rights over your data.
The NSA is not specifically targeting American citizens in this. And, you know, you've talked about incidental collection.
Yes.
And I think that's something that we want to kind of lay out a little bit so people can understand what we're talking about.
Yeah. So there's a lot of steps involved here. The first step is targeting. Who is permitted to be targeted? So under 12333, only foreign persons can be targeted in general. In very limited cases, U.S. persons can be targeted. But the targeting is less of a constraint than it might sound like, because the way it works is like this. They say, well, there's a foreign person in Pakistan who, you know, maybe is aligned with ISIS or Al-Qaeda. They're using Gmail. That means we can go and take all the Gmails, not just their Gmails, all the Gmails. So literally billions of people can be swept up. Their data can be swept up, including millions of Americans, on the basis of targeting a single person.
I see your brain working. You can't see it, obviously, over the podcast, but there's a lot of conversations I think you're having internally about making sure you don't say something you're not supposed to say.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think is interesting about your particular whistleblower case is that you're always very careful when you talk to anybody on the outside. You know, I read something where you always have somebody with you when you meet with the press. You always want to make sure you don't release anything you shouldn't. And when you finally wrote this op-ed, I was interested to see that you actually cleared it with both State Department and NSA, much in the same way anyone writing a book would have to go through the Publication Review Board with CIA. How did that, handing that to NSA, saying, I'm going to write this op-ed in the Washington Post, how did that go?
It went reasonably well. First of all, Mark here was my lawyer. He gave me good advice on how to do it. I had to handwrite the op-ed because obviously the reason they review this stuff is to make sure that there's no classified information in there. Until they've reviewed it, they don't know whether or not there's classified information. And putting classified information on an unsecured computer system is itself a crime. So they require you to handwrite or typewrite on an old-fashioned typewriter these submissions for pre-publication review. So that's what I did. I handwrote it. I FedExed it in, and it was really within, about 3 weeks, they came back and said, we didn't find anything classified here. You can publish it.
And you're law trained yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. What's interesting also is you actually were praised by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence for going through the route that you went through. Because as I said in the introduction, you didn't just go to the post. You actually worked these concerns through the required levels of whistleblowing.
Yeah. So they did compliment me. They commended me for saying, for using the process that they had set up. And one of the things I learned from this was, look, this process is imperfect. It's not good enough at protecting whistleblowers. It's still far too easy to fire someone for coming forward with a complaint. Nevertheless, it's actually more powerful than many people understand. And even with things that the government might consider classified, there are often a lot of legal ways to make that public. Sometimes it takes more time than just calling up a reporter or going to WikiLeaks. Maybe it takes a few months, but it's often possible. So there is actually a document declassification process that you can try to use. You can bring lawsuits in court to try to publish things, really with a First Amendment claim. I have a right to speak what I believe, and the public has a right to know this stuff. You're not going to win every one of those cases, but you'll win some of them. And often that can bring a lot of attention to bear on issues, even if you end up losing the case. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you're the new organization that you and Mark are here to talk about, Whistleblower Aid. I think people may immediately respond to this saying, "What makes you different than the WikiLeaks of the world? What makes you not an organization trying to focus on people leaking out information? There's so many leaks, whether it's not just new because of the Trump administration. There was leaks on top of leaks on top of leaks during the Obama administration as well. They were very harsh in the way they prosecuted those. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, conflate whistleblowing and leaking. So what really differentiates this organization from something like a WikiLeaks, where you're trying to inspire people to put out information the government certainly doesn't want made public?
Well, we're nothing like WikiLeaks. I mean, for one thing, WikiLeaks doesn't have any regard for the U.S. government. People could argue it has the exact opposite. It's there to receive information illegally and then publicize it, regardless of the consequences. I've been representing national security whistleblowers for over 20 years. The goal is not to destroy the United States. The goal is to hold the United States accountable for anything that it's doing that it shouldn't be doing, that is improper, unethical, illegal. But at the same time, it's there to protect the whistleblower. People who are coming forward and doing the right thing shouldn't have to worry about losing their job, career, maybe even family, depending on how the situation goes. And in fact, the United States, on paper, promotes whistleblowers and their existence. And we want to make sure that that's a reality. So for one thing, we do not receive classified information. We will not take it. I mean, I don't do that in my law practice. I won't do it in this new legal organization. It's illegal, and we don't have the storage capability that's approved by the U.S. government. Now, I get classified information different from documents all the time because I have a security clearance in the cases that I handle. That's a completely different situation. But we will take whistleblowers and provide free legal services to walk them through the system. Some of what John described, I did for him. And we will do it completely legally with hopefully protection for the individual. Having a lawyer makes unbelievable difference in the world. When we will not disclose classified information. That is not the goal of the organization. That shouldn't be the goal of anyone doing real whistleblower work, quite frankly, for both the whistleblower, hopefully, and even and certainly the lawyers, because we're bound by ethical obligations that don't exist for journalists, don't exist certainly for groups like WikiLeaks. We have to protect the individual. And for holding a security clearance, I have competing obligations to protect the national security information, which I will emphasize is not trumped and as pun intended, by my legal obligations. So in no way, shape, or form would I ever, could I ever betray the confidence of a client because there's national security information involved. The client's interests come paramount, and that for one thing is a huge difference between anyone else that would be purporting to protect whistleblowers when they're disclosing classified information.
When you guys announced this on Monday, immediately you caught the attention of WikiLeaks. If you follow any WikiLeaks or Mark on Twitter, you'll notice that they didn't take too well to this new organization. They actually called you a whistleblower honey trap, which you kind of have to frame that somewhere because it's delicious. What makes you a threat to them? Like, why? It almost seems, from the outside, a layperson may look and be like, everyone's kind of working on the same team in this respect. Like, why are they so knee-jerk negatively reacting to this new whistleblower aid?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I guess we'll have to ask Julian why he feels so threatened by me. I suppose I can say some of my responses back, and besides just kind of laughing at the comments that they were tweeting out to 5 million people, some of the response really is, okay, we are offering free legal advice to protect whistleblowers, to hold the U.S. government accountable for any wrongdoing, and you're, what, against that? All right, so maybe that says a lot more about them than it does about us, and I'd encourage anyone who's following them or supports them to, you know, take a long, hard look at my track record, at John's track record, of what we've tried to do, of what this organization is set to do, which is completely nonpartisan. You know, we've been praised so far by members of Congress, both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, as well as by people inside and outside of government.
Yeah, former CIA directors have come out.
Yeah, I mean, we, and privately, I received tremendous amount of support from people who are currently in government. The whole purpose of this organization is we're not an anti-government organization. We want to work with the government to better the government, to strengthen the whistleblower laws. And, you know, look, most honest folks that I know in the government, and, you know, many people involved with the Spy Museum have been involved with the government at some point in their careers. You know, there are an incredible number, vast majority of people who are honest in the U.S. government and want nothing more than to ensure the government operates ethically and legally and are supportive of whistleblowers. And when we can bring cases like John's was and show that, you know what, the system can work, what the understanding is that when you become a whistleblower and you bring information forward, it doesn't mean everything's going to stop on a dime and that everything you think you want to happen will happen. That's just not reality in many things. Marriage, divorce rate wouldn't be at like 65%. But the difference is to be able to bring the information forward legally to save the person's career and also make a difference in the discussion of whatever that information is to hopefully change, whether incrementally or maybe even dramatically, whatever that issue was.
Well, John, let me ask you, because if you research whistleblower organizations, there are some out there. The U.S. government has a whistleblower protection program. There's right here in D.C. is the National Whistleblower Center. Why do we need a new organization? What's missing without, you know, I'm not going to ask you to directly criticize anybody else, but what holes do you guys fill that aren't being filled right now?
So first of all, we have a very strong focus on security. I would say over the last several months, as we've been preparing to launch this organization, at least 80% of my time has been building secure systems to protect our clients, to protect prospective clients, to protect our supporters who go on our website and give us money. And so very deliberately, there's only one way to contact us, and it's called SecureDrop, and it's on the Tor Hidden Services Network, which is basically a special hidden, encrypted, anonymous part of the internet used by human rights activists, by journalists, also by bad people all over the world to try to do things in a secure, safe way. So in order to even contact us, you have to install something called Tor Browser, which you can get online. You can go to our website, whistlebloweraid.org. There's full instructions there. You enter a special onion URL into Tor Browser, and that's the only way you'll be able to send us a message. And that's really to earn the trust of people who work in signals intelligence, who understand the scope of surveillance today, who understand that really email is not safe, telephones are not safe, text messages are not safe, normal web phones are not, web forms are not safe. We're trying to create the safest mechanism for clients to contact us, and we think that's really going to appeal to a lot of people. So that's one thing that we're bringing to the table. The other thing is, look, I think a lot of people today recognize that there are some serious threats to the rule of law today, maybe exceptional threats beyond what's happened in the past. And we are making a huge public push to bring more people into understanding these issues, to create a larger pool of potential whistleblowers. So we're running ads in half of the DC Metro rail cars for this month. We have two of those big, obnoxious mobile billboards that drive around on the back of flatbed trucks, which are driving around the White House, you know, down K Street, Farragut West, near the Capitol. We're going to the intelligence buildings themselves, so the NSA, the CIA, the Pentagon. We had a full-page ad on the back of the Express. We have street teams handing out whistles with our cards attached. All this really trying to change the national conversation on whistleblowing to bring more people into the fold.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
One thing I noticed actually that was interesting to me was transition assistance, because as you mentioned, this may not go all that well for you if you decide to come forward and become a whistleblower. You've turned it into a pretty healthy career, but that's not always the case. I mean, yeah. Whether you want to call someone like Thomas Drake a whistleblower or a leaker, he lost his security clearance, he was very high up in NSA, and now he doesn't have that same opportunity. There are times when things go badly, even if you follow all the rules. What can we do, again, not only as your organization, but what can we do as national security experts and people within this field to start trying to redefine the afterlife of a whistleblower? They're looking
sure.
at each other to decide who gets the response.
Sure. So, absolutely. So one of the things we've been talking about for the last few months is it's scary to be a whistleblower. So obviously the security I mentioned is one of the things we're trying to do to help reassure people, to try to build trust with clients. But you know what? The protections are not strong enough today, and you might be fired from your job. And, you know, we can try to bring a claim and get your job back, but I can't promise you we're going to win. So with that, we're trying to provide a full set of services to support more people and make more people feel comfortable coming forward. So everything from coaching with a public relations team and media coaching, if you're going to the media, if you're testifying to Congress, to literally financial help with your rent or your mortgage for several months while you find a new job, to even helping you network and find a new job. We have a lot of people who support whistleblowers out there. We know almost all of them. They all want to help clients and whistleblowers. And, you know, if you are someone with, you know, technical chops who knows about, you know, penetrating computer systems, that type of stuff, there's a lot of work out there for you, and we'll help you find that. To even handing you a clean, dedicated, secure device that you use to communicate with us about your case, so that any communications you have are not on your personal computer, on your personal phone. To even, you know, psychosocial counseling and treatment for people who are often going through some of the most stressful times in their lives.
And I guess I would also add, just going a little bit back, the organization is not there to compete with other organizations that represent whistleblowers. You know, sadly, there's more than enough work to go around. We do have a national security background that doesn't necessarily exist elsewhere, and a focus from many, many years. Although we are not isolated to national security at all, we'll represent whistleblowers throughout the federal government and the contracting world. But the strength there, and of course what the notoriety is in the last decade or so, has been from national security whistleblowers. And that's where the line could be crossed as far as going into criminality, that we want to protect someone. If someone at the Department of Education wants to blow the whistle on something that Betsy DeVos is doing, you know, they may face repercussions by loss of job, but they're unlikely to go to jail, and we'd be more than happy to help them. In fact, if the information is unclassified, we'd be more than happy to help whistleblowers take their story public. The difference, so when we talk about from WikiLeaks, the difference here is we are not going to allow or be involved with the illegal aspects of what we'll say whistleblowing, and there's legal issues that involve that, but just as a generic term. So there's one distinction that's there. But having represented whistleblowers for so many years, I see all the stresses that they go in. I echo what John says, you know, not fun to be a whistleblower in any shape or form. And I've had some real successes with people like John where they've done really well after, and sad to say I've had some real failures, or at least in the sense of how I would judge it. I don't think the whistleblower did very well in their world afterwards. A lot of that comes down to what the whistleblower, of course, wants to do. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a psychologist, psychiatrist, or counselor. I can't help in that standpoint. But the group that we're representing and handling actually can. And most whistleblowers never get that type of help along the way. They get very isolated, and it's incredibly difficult for them at work, even in their family, where they might not be able to share information. I think we are the first full-service organization in that sense that I know of who is not only there to legally protect the whistleblower, but also to help the whistleblower get through the process.
Yep.
Mentally, securely, psychologically.
It's incredibly difficult to go outside of the chain of command. I mean, I think the higher you get, it's easier. But you think of somebody, you know, we can argue all day about Chelsea Manning one way or the other about leaks or whistleblowing or anything like that. But if you did think that she was a whistleblower versus a leaker, as a PFC that's very low in the chain of command, and because if she had just whistleblown declassified information, it still would have been an incredibly difficult decision for somebody at that level. So if you're a rank and file worker at DOD or at CIA, the choices are far more difficult, I would argue, than if you're an assistant deputy director seeing something, because that's the beginning of your career. You've just finished going through, let's say you got a PhD, and you know 10 years of your life was spent trying to get this job at CIA, and you're risking all of that to, you know, talk about some kind of thing that may not, and you could be cynical enough to say, well, it may not change everything. Because, I mean, how much, John, can you say, and I'm not trying to be critical about what you did, but how much can you possibly say was changed by your whistleblowing?
Yeah, well, I would say one of the successes was we've put this issue on the map, and now people understand that 12333 is being used in this way. Advocacy groups are pursuing it. I agree the policy has not yet changed. It's something I'm still very concerned about. Part of the issue is changing policies in democratic governments takes time. It takes building coalitions and building power. And it's especially difficult when it involves classified programs because there's not the normal level of public democratic debate about these things. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. And, you know, I don't want to raise anyone's hopes that the minute you come out and say all the bad things that are going to happen, you know, that are happening, that everything is going to change. No, it takes work. And that's what we are committed to. We are committed to building a community, a powerful community that supports whistleblowers and that ultimately does bring about the changes that we want to see and make, you know, make our government stronger and more representative of, you know, the American people. I was thinking about WikiLeaks, how we're different from WikiLeaks. When I started at the State Department, I took an oath, as everyone does who works for the government, to support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I take that very seriously. Every indication is, and certainly the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence community is, that WikiLeaks deliberately helped the Russian government to undermine the 2016 presidential election. It's hard to think of a more serious threat to the Constitution of the United States than that. Whistleblower Aid, our organization, is very much trying to uphold the oath, and I think that anyone who supports WikiLeaks should think about what role WikiLeaks is playing in this whole environment, and I don't think it's a positive one.
And Vince, going back to what you're talking about with Manning, that's one of the failures in the system that Whistleblower Aid would like to correct. Manning had some legitimate, reasonable concerns about specific items. But as a PFC in the Army, at 19 years old, knowing how to go through the system is probably going to be unlikely, right, especially when Manning was in another country at the time in Iraq. Yeah. One of the things that we are advocating, and certainly I've been doing so for quite a while, is if the United States government is so strong on paper in advocating for the existence of whistleblowers, including presidents have said so. I mean, Obama issued PPD, Presidential Directive 19. President Trump has spoken favorably, frankly, about whistleblowers
ago,
at the United Nations,
yeah,
at the Veterans Affair. Hasn't dealt with it in the realm that we're talking about, but there have been favorable statements. You know, every federal employee goes through annual EEO discrimination training. And it's on the computer most of the time, so you may be just hitting the screen and the buttons, look through. And why isn't the same thing being done for whistleblowing? So that if you have a concern, if you see something that is unlawful, gross mismanagement, waste, fraud, abuse, I mean, whistleblowing, the language is very, very broad. It's not just even unlawful conduct, which is most of the time what we deal with, but it could be just gross mismanagement, quite frankly. You know, why isn't there some sort of training to tell people so that the Mannings of the world will know, okay, if I see a concern, this is who I can go to first, not by name, of course. This is the level I can go to first. If I'm not satisfied with that, this is where I could go to. If I'm not satisfied with that, I could go to the outside government organization. I can go to inspector generals. I can go to the Hill, my member of Congress, the oversight committees, other agents, depending on where you are. If you work at the CIA, you don't have to just go to the CIA inspector general. You can go to the Office of Director, National Intelligence Inspector General. And having worked with these agencies, I can tell you, they're not necessarily there to protect each other. In fact, very often, they're at odds with each other. And I have cases now where one agency is investigating the other agency's IG. The system can work if there are people who are involved who know how to try and make it work. Doesn't mean it's going to be successful, and a lot of times it's going to fail. Hey, I knew when we brought John up to the NSA Inspector General's office, we weren't going to change their minds. at all. We weren't going to get a remedy from that, but we wanted to demonstrate to them that we took this seriously, and we took their role in it seriously, and we had some very good substantive conversations that I think were helpful on both sides. And the fact that they praised, and DNI praised how John went through the process, shows not that by WikiLeaks, you know, saying that somehow this is an entrapment plan to expose whistleblowers, but actually to show that there are those in the government who believe in whistleblowers, but just want the system to work and the people to go through the proper channels.
Well, let me just state very clearly, this is not an entrapment plan for whistleblowers. Our first priority is to protect our clients at all costs, and we are ethically obligated to do so. That's why we've implemented all these security measures.
Well, I think the warrant canary was something that was interesting on the website. I found that. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because there certainly has there's a dynamic there that not only demonstrates that you are working on behalf of people, your clients, but that you do understand this relationship between the federal government and people who are currently working for the federal government.
So there are various legal mechanisms that the government can use, some which do not require court approval, to send sealed requests for demands for information from various parties. For example, a national security letter can be issued more or less unilaterally by the executive branch to entities, asking them for certain information and saying it's illegal to disclose what we're even asking you or to tell anyone that we've made this request. We have put up on the website a warrant canary, like a canary in the coal mine. Okay, and it's in quotes, and it says something along the lines of whistleblower aid has not received any sealed government or law enforcement requests for information about its clients or supporters. And that's up there. It's true right now. We have not received any such requests. It would be illegal for us to say if we had received a request, but it's not illegal for us to simply strike out that phrase if it's no longer true, because under the First Amendment, we can't be compelled to say something that isn't true.
Right.
So this is really a way to, it's another step we're taking to try to build trust with our clients.
So let's. I imagine there are listeners out there screaming, and you know, in the same vein as Edward Snowden probably is reacting to this, saying, "That's all well and good, but some of the most heinous things the U.S. government is doing, some of the most unethical, immoral things we're doing, can't be whistleblown in the legal sense because they're classified." So what's from keeping government agencies from classifying things they don't want to be whistleblown about, or even if it's not that nefarious, even if we get rid of all the law breaking being done and all the mismanagement being done that's declassified, there's still a massive potential amount of bad acting going on in the classified world.
Absolutely, and we 100% agree that the government abuses its authority to classify information sometimes in order to shield itself from scrutiny, in order to hide illegal activity. We agree with that occurs, and that is a very serious problem. What I'd say is, first of all, the mechanisms are imperfect, but they are still there. And if we can help people use them, and try to bring these abuses to light in a way that doesn't expose you to years in prison or exile to a hostile foreign country, we want to do that. So this really is a client-focused effort. The mechanisms are imperfect, but they are there, and they might be more powerful than you think. And you know, part of the long-term effort here is to improve those mechanisms and to make them more perfect. I would say, if you come to us, we'll give you our best advice. We'll try to, in that situation in which there's a classified fact and it feels like there's nothing to do except leak it, we'll talk through all your legal options with you. And if at the end of it, you decide, you know, your conscience tells you you have to leak this, you know, that's up to each client. We don't control our clients. We give them our advice. We try to help them. We represent their interests. We keep their secrets, but we don't control them. And, you know, after you talk to us, you still have all the options you had before you talked to us. And, you know, we would never say anything you ever told us. We're bound by attorney-client privilege to keep your secrets.
And is part of the mission to, if they're in a position where they can't legally whistleblow something as a classification, is there even ideas about trying to get things FOIA'd or declassified so that they can, in fact, have conversations about what they might see as a moral ethical issue?
Absolutely. There are a number of mechanisms that we can do. When, let's say, if someone came to us and identified, without revealing, hopefully, to us that there's classified, the specifics of the classified information, and frankly, I've done this in numerous times with clients, there are ways in which I can phrase things in the FOIA request to put it in and sue on those grounds. Now, that's a statutory ground. No person has any greater right than anyone else in pursuing information in that way. But there have been times where actually I purposely, either myself or a lawyer working for me, kept them out of the classified loop so that they could write an unclassified document that went to federal court to essentially blow the whistle on some aspects of things that I was able to feed information to them completely unclassified so that they didn't have to worry about pre-publication review because they didn't have any obligation and we didn't have to worry about what was in the document. At the same time, we can do what we did, we would have done for John and John mentioned, is by submitting something for pre-publication review while the person is either still inside the agency, which we've done before, or even now outside the agency but still has an obligation, if we sue on that, if NSA had withheld, frankly, even three words from John's op-ed, we would have filed a lawsuit under the First Amendment, which is now a greater right than FOIA as a statute, because John, or the individual, has that constitutional right to free speech if it's unclassified. And then we use the legal vehicle in that manner to challenge the information. And there have been a number of times where I've litigated against the CIA about highly classified information, and by filing the lawsuit, even with much less information, of course, because the document's unclassified, that there have been generated number of news stories and congressional interests and investigations into what was going on by the mere fact of us going to a federal court and litigating the issue. That would be an incredibly powerful weapon that, frankly, other than in my law practice and maybe every once in a while that I see elsewhere, is not done very often, either because the costs are too high or the clients don't want it or maybe the lawyers don't know how to do it. Well, we know how to do it in whistleblower aid, and we will do it, and we won't hesitate to do it. And it's not just here we go down this route, we go down this route. We can go down multiple routes all at the same time. It's much in the way, and I think I've described it before in other podcasts, a guerrilla warfare against the U.S. government. They are the 800-ton gorilla. All right, we are these little lawyers and whistleblowers. But, you know, there was a reason why in the American Revolution we were able to defeat the British. The big, powerful, most powerful army, military, navy in the world at the time. You know, we hit, strike, and run. Hit, strike, and run. And we just keep on hitting until we can get our points across to get a discussion and hopefully effect change.
You mentioned some names of some famous people who've been in the news lately and this dilemma about what to do if you're faced with classified information that you think shows serious government lawbreaking and you don't know how to deal with it. First of all, I have a tremendous amount of compassion for people in this situation. I wasn't quite in that situation really because I was a lawyer. I had the money to pay lawyers. And so I was more empowered than many people who find themselves in that situation. And it's honestly very tough. On the one hand, you have, when you get your security clearance, you are very clearly taught and you sign all these forms stating that you will not release classified information. You have a legal duty. You probably have a moral duty in most cases, because honestly, a lot of the reason many things are classified is to protect human intelligence, to protect sources. And so there's good reasons for those protections, and I support those. At the same time, you have taken an oath to protect the Constitution and laws of this country. And if you're seeing abuses of the Constitution and the laws, you actually have a duty to try to combat it. And that can put you in a very difficult place. And so I have a lot of compassion for those people. And in fact, that's why we created this project, is because not everyone has the advantages that I had. Justice should be blind. It's not always blind. And often it's the more powerful person who is already running the government, who already has tons of money to litigate things, that wins. This effort is trying to reverse that dynamic and trying to empower these people who are in this difficult position. I would say, people ask, is whistleblowing the same as leaking? Are they different? The way I think about it, whistleblowing is reporting and exposing lawbreaking by government agencies or officials. Leaking is disclosing classified information to someone who isn't allowed to receive it. I think of it as a Venn diagram with the circles, right? There's a circle for whistleblowing. There's a circle for leaking. And they're overlapping circles. They're not identical circles. So you can be a whistleblower without being a leaker. So if it's not involved classified information, and you come out and show that there's some kind of corruption in an agency that's not classified, you're a whistleblower. You haven't leaked any classified information. You can leak classified information without being a whistleblower. So for instance, if you're leaking, you know, top secret documents from an intelligence agency that don't show law breaking by the U.S. government, you are leaking, but you're not a whistleblower. And there is probably some overlap where people who are leaking classified documents of that show illegal activity by the government are both leakers and whistleblowers. Right. Now, that's obviously I would say a moral gray area. And I think reasonable people can disagree about it. I personally have a lot of compassion for people who find themselves facing those choices. And this organization is here to try to help them avoid going to prison or going into exile.
Well, I think you were kind of in that position where you had access to classified information, but because you had the ability to hire a lawyer, because you had the ability yourself as a Yale law grad.
Yeah.
We went 45 minutes without you mentioning that you went to Yale Law School, so I applaud you. You're the only human being who has ever been a graduate of Yale Law who hasn't mentioned it within the first 30 seconds. But you had that knowledge, you had the money, you had the ability to do that, to separate the classified from the declassified. So you're able to be a whistleblower without leaking classified information. Is that a model for people who have access to classified information, who may see things that they're worried about? How do I release certain things without releasing the classified side? I mean, again, I don't want to wade too far into the Snowden Manning hot button issues, but I can imagine somebody at an NSA or a CIA who's looking at a situation where you're like, man, there's something really morally wrong with this. How do I get word out about it without breaking the law?
Come to us. That's the answer. Okay, and the reason is, I don't want you to go to prison. I want you to ideally keep your job, and if you can't keep your job, I want to help you get a new job that you'd probably like even better, honestly. I want these abuses to come to light, and I don't want you to go to prison. So I'm not saying every case is different, and these are very complex legal and moral issues, so I don't want to give any firm answer, but we are here to try to help you crack that nut and solve that problem.
And in a perfect world then, Mark, you don't exist in 10 years. I mean, there's no need for you anymore, right? I mean, you're basically, your business model is designed for you. If you succeed, that you won't need to be around anymore.
That would be fine with me. I have a lot of other things I would love to do, including docenting at the International Spy Museum. So no problem with that. I would love to think that. I've been around Washington now for almost a quarter century. I doubt that will happen in 10 years, much less my lifetime.
We know, but it will never happen. We know it will never happen, because in every society, in every government on earth throughout history, rule of law needs to be protected, needs to be improved. And, you know, we love our country, but that doesn't mean we have a perfect country, and it doesn't mean our government is perfect. No matter who's the president, there are going to be concerns. I was personally a whistleblower under the Obama administration, right? We're launching this under the Trump administration. Obviously, we have concerns about the rule of law today, serious concerns. But whoever's president next, there will be concerns then too, no matter which party or which person controls the government.
Yeah, I mean, especially under The Rock. I mean, Dwayne Johnson as president is going to worry about whistleblowing there. You've already talked a little bit.
Fast and Furious.
Yes.
Anyway.
That would be life imitating art and vice versa. So where are we when it comes to providing this beyond Washington, D.C.? Is there even thought about, or are you just trying to keep it local?
As far as the United States or outside the United States?
Yeah, I mean, you're thinking like, you talk about, you know, Chelsea Manning was in Iraq, Snowden was in Hawaii. Although he might have gone there on purpose, but Washington, of course, is his own little bubble, but the potential for people who are seeing lawbreaking may not be under the watchful gaze of those here in Washington. It may be on the outskirts where there's less oversight, there's less people looking at what you're doing. That might be actually where this is most needed.
Sure. We're not at all isolated geographically to Washington, D.C. The advertising campaign is more limited to Washington, D.C. for obvious reasons.
So many federal workers are. Yeah.
Right, where all the federal workers are. Obviously a large number of them. There's a lot all across the world. But that's the whole purpose of setting up the secure Tor browser system for people to communicate in that manner through Signal, other ways, phone, at least to set up a process. There's certainly ways in which either the whistleblower, potential whistleblower, or we as the lawyers can travel to go meet with people. I mean, you know, if you look at the classified leak cases in the last 15 years, again, without getting into whether they're whistleblowers or not, just as a fact, most of them ended up getting caught because of technological problems that the government was allowed to or able to legally exploit and find them. So there are some values to, you know, meeting in a garage parking lot at 1:30 in the morning, a la Deep Throat, to ensure that the government can't identify who the whistleblowers are. And that's not at all limited to geographical problems. So, have will, have travel, so to speak, however that saying goes. We're there to protect anyone who has information about the United States government and wrongdoing, mismanagement, whatever it might be.
And even more broadly, I mean, look, we're a scrappy startup. We have just a small band of intrepid lawyers and others, working right now. Obviously, we need to raise a lot of money. We don't have enough money to do everything we want to do right now. So please, you know, get on the website, give us some money, tax deductible. But assuming we do succeed, we want to expand this beyond the U.S. federal government. Why not? In local police forces and prosecutors' offices, there's allegations and often evidence that there are abuses going on. Innocent people do sometimes get railroaded in the criminal justice system, and that's a serious problem. And there's people in these agencies that know about it. Why shouldn't we be representing them and helping them come forward and expose these abuses? If private companies, tax evasion, environmental crimes, regulatory issues, even foreign governments. I mean, we would love to become preeminent, premier law firm, legal group. We're a nonprofit that relies on donations around the world, helping people, deal with these kind of issues.
So Mark Zaid, John Tai are the founders of Whistleblower Aid. It's whistlebloweraid.org is the website. You can check it out. All the stuff that they're thinking of doing, and that'll also tell you if you're a potential whistleblower out there, how you can get in touch with them. I think it makes a ton of sense that if you're thinking about doing anything, at least figure out what your options are before you go ahead, because that's,
especially from legal advice, yeah. At least do that before you decide what you want to do.
And if you end up not taking our advice, you know, your secrets stay with us.
Well, and there's no, I know for a lot of people, financial constraints of going to some high-priced lawyer like Mark Zaid would be difficult to do. That's not a hindrance anymore.
Yep.
All right, gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. We truly appreciate it, and good luck moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.